we start today's episode, just to let you know, you can now nominate for the 2025 Northern Power Women Awards to be in with a chance of celebrating with changemakers, trailblazers and advocates on the 6th of March 2025. Nominate now at wearepower.net.
Northern Power Women Podcast. For your career and your life, no matter what business you're in.
Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Northern Power Women Podcast. Women are more up for it. Whilst it's freezing outside and you're panicking about the number of days left until Christmas, it's less than you think. Be warmed and buoyed by another hour of brilliant discussion, insight, and inspiration. Now, this month, we're in Newcastle for our live recording at Newcastle University Business School. It was an extremely eye-opening, and I won't lie, sometimes quite upsetting look at a very different aspect of the North-South divide and why we, in the North, actually die sooner than our neighbours in the South.
Is it to do with the people that live in the North? Is it something to do with Northerners, right? Or is it something to do with the North as a place?
And just a heads up, we also have a very deep and meaningful conversation about hugging. Just saying, that's also on there. In this month's interview, you will hear from a woman whose heart remains in the North, even though she's worked in the South for much of her career, managing director of Duke's Hotels, Deborah Duggar. And she reflects on the realities of being a woman in a man's world.
In those days, I remember the day I actually gave birth to Lauren, the next day I got a telephone call from my boss at the time, and his question to me was, when are you coming back to work? I'd literally only given birth 12 hours beforehand.
And in Ask the Hive, Kate is struggling with hearing feedback from her bosses, and you step in with some advice.
People generally have your best interests at heart, so why is that important, and how do you want to take it forward?
But first, it's time for you to stand up and then curtsy. Or maybe take a bow as we catch up with the one and only founder of Northern Power Women, Simone Roche, who this month had a very special royal appointment.
November, you have been right royally epic, literally royal. I was beyond honoured to be presented with my MBE by His Royal Highness, the Duke of Cambridge, who I got one-to-one time with, of course, talking about Northern Powerhouse, Northern Power Women, men as agents of change, and our fantastic people and role models we've got across the North. It was brilliant to share the day with our power lister, Marnie Millard, who got her OBE, and also there was Dame Emma Thompson, no less. Thank you for the hundreds of messages, many of them which were hand-painted into my dress, which was made with love and care by the Beattie sisters, who have a brand called Careu, who have created a STEM-inspired dress with the uniqueness so that it zips around the middle for that change of look, mainly depending on which role you're going to be meeting at the time. Well, you would think a day at the palace would ensure that the month will be spectacular, but no, in true Northern Power Women style, it's been supported by a stellar lineup of activities and proactivity. Big thanks to the Northern Health Science Alliance for sponsoring this month's episode, which we recorded at Newcastle University. Thank you, Dr. Hakim Yadi, OBE, Professor Claire Bamborough and Dr. Michelle Addison, and we were delighted to support the launch of the NHSA report as well. Find out more by listening to this podcast. It was great to have Power Lister and wonderful friend on our Person with Purpose interview this week, so take a listen to Deborah Duggar. So what else has happened in November? Well, we hosted our Connection event for our new Michael Page mentoring programme, bringing senior execs together with future female leaders. We launched our Agents of Change survey on International Men's Day, looking at the behaviours and positive actions that men take in boardrooms to be able to encourage and foster more action as opposed to passivity. But find out more and take part in the survey on our Northern Power Women website. We've had calls with Jake Berry's office, the Minister for the Northern Powerhouse, and we're progressing this inclusion role, and more news of that will come in the new year. Northern Power Futures came to Manchester at the end of November, opening with 300 young adults and a giant speed mentoring event with 92 leaders, entrepreneurs and influencers. We had 1,700 people over the 2 days at Manchester Central, and we had 120 speakers and panellists. Thank you so much to EY, Vodafone, Cooperative Bank and many more who supported this fantastic groundbreaking event. Look out for the next event on the 10th, 11th of February in Newcastle at the Boiler Shop. It's great to speak at a few events this month, including the Northern Economic Summit, the Public Sector Show, She's the Business and at the University of Manchester, plus a brilliant diversity and equality event at Yorkshire Building Society. Also thrilled to appear on our future list, Stacey Copeland's BBC Radio Manchester show as well. Fantastic discussions on there, so please tune in to her dead good show. We also launched a work shadowing programme supporting the Bridge Greater Manchester Combined Authority, getting more young people into work shadowing opportunities with Andy Burnham, which was fantastic to be a part of. And nominations are closed for the 4th Northern Power Women Awards, with almost 900 nominations, and I do not envy the job of our 60 plus judges who have now got to come together. And watch out for those shortlists in the new year, which will be announced on the 8th of January. And breathe. Fantastic November. You were totally, totally amazing. Have a fantastic December and we'll see you all next month. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Simone Roche MBE. Brilliant stuff. Time now to listen into the fascinating and often concerning discussion that we had this month in Newcastle, and thanks to our hosts at the Business School at Newcastle University.
Oh, that's put a lovely smile on my face. How glorious. Well, the sun is shining. An absolutely fantastic northeast welcome today to the University of Newcastle Business School. Thank you so much for being here and being part of the recording of episode 18. Woo! Yes, I know, of the Northern Power Women podcast. We've come so far, Simone. Happy days. As ever, we've got three fantastic people on our panel today. And we're talking about, as ever, a whole range of subjects, as we always do during our fantastic panel discussion. So please welcome today to Dr. Michelle Addison, Research Associate at Newcastle University Institute of Health and Society. Michelle's a social scientist interested in health and social inequalities, gender and illicit substances. Also a big hello to Claire Bambra, who's a Professor of Public Health at Newcastle University. Her research focuses on understanding and reducing health inequalities, with particular regard to the effects of social policies and health care systems. And last but absolutely not least, a huge welcome to Dr. Hakeem Yardi, OBE. We like to get someone honoured on the panel. It's becoming a monthly fixture, actually, isn't it? I like that. I like the way we're going on that, Simone. He is the CEO of the Northern Health Science Alliance Limited. Now, that basically represents the interests of Northern hospitals and universities, not just in London, but actually all around the world. So a big welcome to Michelle, to Claire and to Hakeem. Thank you. So let us dive in then with our first question here, please. Now, we talk about the North-South divide a lot on this podcast. We really do. We talk about things like transport infrastructure. We talk about North-South divide in terms of availability of senior management roles, for example. But actually, we've never talked about the North-South divide in terms of health inequalities. And I don't know if you might be shocked to know this, but if you are born and live in the Northeast, statistically, you will actually die several years earlier than if you are born and raised and live in the Southeast. And in fact, you'll have a lot more years of ill health if you live in the northern parts of the UK than the south as well. Let's talk about this. Why is this the case? And how can we move towards changing this? Let me start with you, please, on this, Claire.
Okay, so yes, there is on average a 2-year difference in life expectancy between the northern regions and the southern regions, and it's particularly extreme as between the northeast and the southeast of England. This is something that's been documented for over 150 years, going back to the 1840s when reports were first done and we first started collecting statistics. Of course, the causes then were very different. So if we think of kind of Manchester and Newcastle in the 1840s, heart of the Industrial Revolution, massive exposures to health hazardous working conditions, overcrowding, poor sanitation, leading to big epidemics in cholera and things like that. More exposure for people in the north because of that industrialisation. Roll forward 150 years, we're still, okay, not quite so extreme in terms of the gap, but still a gap. But we have different environment that we live in and a different disease burden. You know, it's not an issue around sewers and so on. We've solved those big public health issues. What is it that's causing the problems today? And I think from a kind of geographical analysis, you can think about two broad elements. Is it to do with the people that live in the north? Is it something to do with northerners, right? Or is it something to do with the north as a place? And if we break that down, then we can think about things like, are northerners, you know, more likely to be living in poverty? Are they more likely to be unemployed, have lower wages? Are they more likely to be working in more stressful or demanding conditions? That kind of element. Are they more likely to, quote, behave badly in terms of higher rates of alcohol or substance use and so on? The second element, is it the place of the north? I think ties in with some of your other podcasts in terms of availability of work, what the local labour market's like in the north. And we know there's less job density in the north than there is, for example, in the south. And that element of productivity, is something that we're looking at in a report that the Northern Health Science Alliance commissioned us to do, to think about how does this health gap between the north and the south tie into a productivity gap that also exists in the north and the south? So if I can just follow up, then there's a documented £4 an hour difference in productivity in the northern economy compared to the southern economy. People have been talking about that. Transport obviously always comes up as one of the issues, connectivity and so on. But we're investigating for the first time the role that this added burden of ill health in the north might be having. And our initial analysis is suggesting that health could actually be a major factor. Higher rates of ill health in the northern regions contributing to this lower productivity. So the north-south health divide is not just about health. It's got bigger implications around productivity and about our future as a country.
And Hakim, is that how we start to make governments stand up and notice? Because, I mean, I know working in the job that I do, this comes around yearly on the news agenda, that your life expectancy, your health broadly is worse than in the south. And yet successive governments, it seems, haven't really taken this on and started tackling this. Is the productivity story how we're going to do this?
So I completely agree with you. Last summer, there was a paper published by the University of Manchester working in collaboration with the University of York that showed, building on the data that Claire was talking about, that you had a 20% higher chance of dying under the age of 75 if you lived in the north. And to bring that to life a bit, that's a million people in the last 50 years dying younger than in the south. A million people. It made the newspapers. It was on Sky. It was everywhere. And then it disappeared.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about it anymore. And it just can't get my head around it. So one of the things that we're hearing at the moment, nationally and internationally, particularly, dare I say the B word, in the context of Brexit, is UK productivity. How can we actually deliver growth for our economies, whether in the north, in Scotland, all across the country? And it seems to be the one thing that everyone wants to talk about is how do we increase productivity? So that got me thinking, you know, what is the health role in productivity? If there is, you know, a £4 per hour per person difference between the north and the south, is health 5p? Is it 15p? Is it 20p? Is it £1.50? What proportion of this is multifactorial. There's skills, it's education, it's transport, but what proportion's health? So I had this fascinating conversation with Claire and her peers across the country and said, point me in the direction of the paper that will tell me the answer. And to my surprise, Claire said, actually, this hasn't been looked into. And so we're tackling this head on, using productivity, hopefully, as something that people can get their heads around, because it's become an issue that everyone wants to resolve. And hopefully, if you combine the health with the productivity, maybe this is something that isn't just a sort of a one-night show on Sky News and disappears the next morning.
It's fascinating to think that still there are, as you said, factors that haven't even been addressed yet, that haven't been investigated yet. Michelle, I know that you talk about gender a lot and work with issues around gender. Is there a gender story to this as well?
I would say so. Just some facts for you. So the gap in life expectancy between the richest and poorest areas turns out to be 7 years for women. So if you live in a rich area, you're going to live 7 years longer than a woman who lives in a more deprived area. That's a massive difference. So I was quite intrigued by Claire's question about, you know, is it about the person, the people of the north, or is it about the place? And I think the research that we do tries to connect both, tries to connect the person with the place, the structural with the personal. So I work in various kinds of research, and I look at substance use. And a lot of that substance use research is with women. And some of the positions on drug use is that it's people who make bad choices. And our research delves a bit deeper into it and women's personal experiences. And why is it that someone might choose to use substances? So I'll tell you a little story. So I spoke to a woman, lovely woman. She had 5 children over a contracted period of time. She had loads going on, loads of stressful things that she had to manage, universal credit applications, getting the kids to school, lots of different things. And so her story was she'd started using speed to help her get out of bed, manage undiagnosed postnatal depression and things like that.
And put more hours in the day, I guess, as well. She wasn't sleeping. She didn't have time to sleep.
Absolutely. Mm. So this woman lived in a situation in a deprived area. She wasn't getting the support she needed from services. She had loads of demands on her time. She was having mental health issues. And so she self-medicated using speed and was getting herself involved in all kinds of different things. And obviously, that's going to be having an impact on her health. So we could frame that as, well, that woman, she's making bad choices. Or you could look at her wider circumstances and say, hang on a second, she's dealing with so many different stressful things that someone else, I don't know, in a different, more affluent area of the country might not have to deal with. So I think there's lots going on there, I think, particularly for women.
I think as well, when you look down to things like food and the availability of healthy food, and it's still cheaper to buy a deep pan frozen pizza than it is a bag of washed salad. And people say, well, eat healthily, don't eat junk food. And we know that junk food and poor health choices, if you want to call it a choice, leads to things like obesity, dementia, you know, all these factors pull in. So this isn't even just a case of saying put more jobs into an area. There has to be, you're shaking your head, Hakeem. We've opened a can of worms.
Yeah, so one of the things that we were thinking about is historically everyone's thought that all you have to do is do the economic development of an area, put more jobs in an area, and then the health will benefit. Well, you could put all the jobs you like into some of these areas and it's not going to directly benefit someone today or tomorrow, maybe generationally, but in terms of actually having an impact today, it's not about creating jobs. It's about intervening in the way that Michelle and Claire are talking about in terms of place and people. And so what we're trying to do, and this is what we're trying to do with the report, is change everyone's way of thinking that actually you might have to invest in health and social care to get productivity.
Who in the audience today knew about the statistic that Michelle just gave us, that there's a 7-year age gap if you were a woman, if you were in an affluent area or a more deprived area? Put your hands up if you knew that. Less than a quarter of the audience.
Can I give you another statistic?
Do. And again, I love a stat. Go on.
I wrote it down, so I got it right. There's a gap of 19 years healthy life expectancy for women who live in a rich and poor area. So basically, that what that means is, although women might live longer, they're going to have far more years in poor health in a deprived area than in an affluent area. I think Claire wants to add to that.
Yeah, Claire, let me lunge round to you. Here we go.
Just to put that into a local context as well, some of our colleagues at University of Newcastle Institute of Ageing did some research looking at the metro lines in Newcastle that stretch from the airport, which is an affluent area, all the way through the city. But if we contrast Biker, you know, as there's a famous Biker Grove in a city deprived area, women there, you're looking at around 11 years less in terms of healthy life expectancy than women living up in the airport region. And what that amounts to is it means that affluent women are not getting a limiting long-term illness until, on average, they're 75. In Biker, they're going to have a disabling condition by the time they're 65.
And also remember, these are averages for that population. So in Baika, the average is 65. So some people might not be getting it till they're 75 in that neighbourhood, but other people will be getting it when they're 50, 55. Now, obviously, that's big health issues, but it also has implications for other things, which I think would be of interest to northern women, is, for example, the WASPI women around the issues around the change of pension age. A lot of the women that have lost out on that are women in deprived neighbourhoods who've worked for a really long time and are having, you know, health problems because they're 55, 57, but we're expecting to get their pension. So there's a real kind of interweaving of kind of economic issues and public health and NHS issues. Mm. And our report is trying to look at one element of that, which is around the role of health in the north-south productivity divide.
Thank you all so much. We could talk about this subject, I know, for many, many, many hours still to come. Do check out the report. We're going to be talking about it more in the podcast the podcast goes on. So do keep listening up. And of course, this is all about starting a conversation as well. If you're like three quarters of the audience here in Newcastle today who weren't aware of these statistics, start that conversation going. Do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. podcast@northernpowerwomen.com. Or of course, you can also tweet @NorthPowerWomen. Now, we're standing, as I said, in the business school here at the University of Newcastle. So let's talk a little bit about women in academia for a moment for our second question, because there are so many female students here, as most universities across the UK, of course. But it seems that not many women choose to walk through university doors once they've graduated to start a career in academia. Michelle, let me start with you. What can we do to change this and to perhaps encourage female leaders in academia?
I think just a caveat to that is to say women are not just a homogenous group as well. I think let's look at it intersectionally in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of different abilities. So even the women who are visible and present in academia, there is still a representation of people who are missing. So what can we do? You know, let's raise the visibility, let's have a strategy in place in terms of diversity, and let's get out there and network in schools, in colleges, and actually try and help people who think that higher education as a career is not for them. Let's actually help them to see it as something that is possible, because I was one of those people. I never for one second thought that I would have a career in academia. You know, a doctor or a professor was just very intimidating to me. And it wasn't until a woman really encouraged me and said, just put in an application, see what happens, took a chance, that it all happened for me. Mm. So I think it was someone else having that belief.
So did you have a career before your current career? How old were you when you kind of entered the academic world?
So I was 24 when I first entered academia. I've always worked in research, but I worked in private sector research. Mm. And research for profit was just not my thing. And I met a really inspiring woman who said, you know, you've got the capabilities to do it. And because I'm first generation higher education. Mm-hmm. Nobody in my family had ever been to university before, so it was like, get in, get out, get your qualifications, go and earn some money. She was fantastic. She said, see what happens. And then I turned up at the interview for my first research assistant post, and I was totally not following the etiquette of how you're supposed to behave in the interview. I still remember it. you know, I was talking about, you know, it's all right, I can get people from Baika, it's fine, my family's from there. And, you know, this woman on the panel took a chance on someone who was very clearly working class at the time, and said, you know, I'll give you your first chance. And I think that's how it works. Mm. Like, other people helping to raise you up. So.
And do you do the same now? Do you find yourself doing the same and going to talk to people and saying, you can do it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, even in terms of the people who I'm involved with in research, colleges and things like that, other peers around me. But I do think that more could be done in terms of intersectional representation, because I look around and I see very, very capable, confident women, and that's brilliant. But I just wonder which one of those out there ever felt like imposters and still feel like those imposters, and should I really be here? I think more could be done.
Hands up in the audience, actually, if there's anyone here who hasn't at some point felt like an imposter. No, Michelle, you know, yeah. Yeah, we all do it. And Hakim, you kept your hand down then as well.
Yeah, I think we all feel like imposters. But I think something... I left academia and went into the world of sort of science meets policy and science meets business. And I actually see a lot of female leadership, as you should expect to see, in that domain. So, the new CEO of the largest charity in the country, Cancer Research UK, is a woman. The largest pharmaceutical company in the UK, GlaxoSmithKline, the CEO is a woman. And I think there's some really good role models in the science meets policy and science meets business world that we should be, to Michelle's point earlier, really using and getting them into the schools, because getting into the schools is so important. And to the point that's been made, it's the different types of groups of people coming through as well. It's not just women as a homogenous group. So when I was a PhD student, I used to go out to schools and talk to kids, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 12-year-olds, about what it might mean to be a scientist. They just think it's a white coat and crazy hair. At the time, I did have crazy hair. And that's been a fascinating sort of experience. And I'm actually going back next year to the place that I did my PhD to work with kids again. Mm. And I think that active role, having someone there to talk to and see what does the pathway look like. But most importantly, it's then people taking a chance on others, and that becomes a very self-fulfilling prophecy.
And of course, what's incredible is I think it's the Chartered Institute of Engineers. Currently, the chair is Dr. And forgive me, I've forgotten the name. I'm going to say Selim, but my brain will tell me off later. And I was reading an interview with Dr. Selim. He said quite often people walk into my office and say, "Where's Dr. Selim?" Expecting a white man. And she says, and I am neither white nor a man. But she actually talks, I mean, engineering is 90% male and 90% white. She says that she truly believes the fact that she comes from neither of those backgrounds is what's got her to where she is, because she always looked at things differently. She didn't look at things the way that everyone else in that sector had historically looked at it. And these are the stories we need to hear more of, I suppose, as well. Claire, you're a woman in academia. Hi.
Hello, yes. There are a lot of women in academia. I think the issue, though, is how far to the top do you get and what are some of the barriers that there might be to you? And I think that is in common with other, you know, with private sector and other elements of the public sector as well. I think perhaps this might be slightly more specific to kind of science and research careers, is that there's a real expectation of you early in your life to be very geographically mobile. So, for example, I did my PhD at Manchester. I then got a job at Liverpool for a couple of years. I then went to Sheffield. I then went up to Durham, and I'm now at Newcastle. And, you know, most of that movement was done very early on, certainly the first few, you know, until the recent move to Newcastle. And you need to be able to go for the next post, for the next job, because science is not just national but international. And I at the time didn't have kids or a family, and I was able to do that movement. I wouldn't be able to do it in the same way now, you know, as you get older. And I think that's a barrier that particularly tends to impact on women more. I find a lot of male colleagues might live in Newcastle, for example, but they're working down at a university in London, because they'll go down on the train, stay a couple of nights, probably have a great time with their mates, and come back up. Meanwhile, who's looking after the children, the dog, and all that kind of thing? It tends to be the wife, who might also be in academia. So there's that kind of issue. Second issue, just reflecting on your point about engineering, there are differences in different parts of academia, so different disciplines. So in the social sciences and in some elements of health, for example, public health particularly, they're quite female, you know, heavy in a good way, right? And so you then, as a kind of cohort effect, you tend to get more women in leadership positions. Then over in the kind of natural hard sciences, it is totally, like you said, with engineering, 90% male, and you can see that. Obviously, that does reflect undergraduate intake to some extent. But there is that. But if we then look above the level of the professor, and you look at the big management jobs within academia, there are very few female vice chancellors, for example, of the top universities. And there does seem to be a point at which it begins to get hard again, because you take on roles where you're not covered by the European Working Time Directive and things like that, and the expectation of your hours then become, you know, open-ended, endless, however you want to look at it. I'm sure that's something in common. I'm seeing people nod in the audience in terms of private sector particularly. So there's that element of how do these jobs match to women's reality rather than some women doing particularly well in structures that are made for men, like, you know, some of the examples that Hakim gave, brilliant, and even more congratulations from doing that. But if we really want more women to achieve, we need to make the world work for women, not just us doing well kind of despite our gender almost.
Who was nodding along in the audience then? I'm going to lunge at you for a comment. Don't be afraid. Does that ring true with you?
Massively, massively. I get very frustrated around some of those stereotypes and expectations on women, particularly around childcare. And it's clearly a limiting issue for everybody. And it really winds me up.
I went on a 4-day press trip to New York. I'm just going to drop that in. And someone actually asked me when I was there, was your husband okay with this? And it's still happening. It's still happening in 2018. Anyone else nodding along? Wow. Fewer people nodding now, they know I'm going to lunge. I did notice that. Yes. Hello.
Yeah, so I work in the private sector. My current company is very London-centric. I've travelled 2-3 days a week since I was 22. I have 2 children. Thank God, a set of grandparents who are retired. My husband works for himself, so can be more flexible. But that's a good example where I have changed my life to be more successful in a tech company that is white, British, male, 50-year-old. You know, I am often the only female in the room, and certainly very often the only under 50 in the room. You know, and it's just, despite the work, I do feel like you have to help people up. You know, I have some excellent female junior and senior managers who need a good shove in the back, you know, to go and just try, you know, just try. And it's because society and the company has told them that they should not try, and that winds me up, actually. You know, it really does. So I wholeheartedly agree. I've moved for work. I moved to Sheffield when I was younger, just before I got married. But doing that, the older you get, gets harder. Yeah. And you know, you've got to find that balance. And the open-ended hours, you know, I can't remember the last time I worked my contracted hours ever. And that's, you know, bad for your mental health. It really is. So wholeheartedly agree. It's really interesting to hear it statistically proven.
Keep your comments coming in. We always say this. This is the start of a conversation at Northern Power Women. At North Power Women is where you can find us on Twitter, podcast at northernpowerwomen.com. Before we move on to the final question, a final comment from Claire.
I just wanted to follow up with what the lady in the audience was just saying, to show that actually there's very strong evidence that longer working hours do not increase productivity either. The UK has the longest average working hours in Europe, but as we know from the report we're looking at, we have this UK productivity crisis. So our current model is not working.
There you go. Love it. Sorted. Right, final question. Let's have it. This is a personal favourite of mine for this recording, in fact. Stop the hugging! is the impassioned plea of author Alison Green. She's a creator of the Workspace advice column, Ask a Manager. She said, whatever happened to the simple handshake at work? Why is everyone now hugging? I'm going to ask the panel today, and then you in the audience. Are you a hugger? Is hugging part of your workplace environment? Do you like it? Hakim.
What a brilliant question. I don't even think the handshake's simple, so let's come back to that one as well. So privately, in my family and with my friends, I'm a hugger. And that's who I am. But I don't expect to bring that necessarily into the workplace. It depends on who you're working with, your working relationship, their cultural backgrounds and their beliefs and their preferences. My team, I'm looking at Hannah in the audience from my team. I think we're quite a huggy team. But
I can't wait to talk to Hannah in a minute.
But it depends on context, doesn't it? I mean, to your point, the simple handshake. In some cultures, it's not a simple handshake. It might be a bow. And so by saying the simple handshake or the hug, I think you're oversimplifying it a little bit, because it depends on the context of who you're talking with and how you know them.
What point in a work relationship do you start to hug?
Hours, minutes, what? I really don't know.
Right, before we move on, Hannah, come on, spill the beans. Pretend he's not here.
I have had a hug off Hakim. It was entirely appropriate. Can I just say that? Yeah, I think as you get to know, we've been working together over two years, as have most of our team, and you get to a stage where you're very comfortable with people. I think on just meeting, I think it's probably not appropriate. Yeah, it'd be a bit odd. But as you develop friendships and relationships, then you kind of know generally. And if you don't know, I think don't hug.
If you don't know, don't hug. Don't assume a hug. Is Newcastle University a huggy environment, Claire?
I would say that our institute actually is. I don't know the rest of university as well, but I think it does come to this issue of different disciplines in university. So healthcare, very female dominated. I think hugging is more, no offence, Hakim, but it's a gendered behaviour. So I think it's more women are more likely to do it with other women. But you know, that's when you've got kind of work relationships that are more like friend ones. So you might go out for cake together, for example, and a coffee. Then I think if you do that, you're more in the hug zone. But I have noticed that, you know, you might go to a meeting, like a national meeting, you have people from Liverpool, whatever, you're not seeing for a while, but you know them really well. So you give them a hug. But then there's someone stood there who you actually kind of know just as well, but they're a guy. And then I'm kind of like, oh, do I hug him as well? And I thought, right, why not? Oh, they don't like it that much. They don't know what to do. They kind of freeze in a kind of like, oh, Claire's hugged me. Even though I've known her for 20 years and we've been for a beer, she's just hugged me. So I think there's a gender element to whether a hug is or is not. And I think women are more up for it.
I was talking. Oh, my gosh. Simone, you know what I'm going to say. Every single episode of the Northern Power Women podcast has a title to it, not just an episode number. Last month's episode was called Invent Your Own Knickers. You will have to listen to the podcast to know why it was called that. Women are more up for it. Yeah. Episode 18 title. Claire, thank you very much indeed. Michelle, it's funny. It's interesting. I was talking to some male colleagues about this and they said there's an issue with the hug. Is it the point when you're in the hug and you're wondering when the hug's going to end? And then what do you say when the hug is finished? I mean, tell me about your relationship with hugging at work.
This question really made me laugh when I heard that we were about... I am not a natural hugger at all. And my social circle really take the mick out of me for it. And now colleagues at the Institute take the mick out of me as well. Particularly, I'm going to name drop a woman. She's amazing. She's called Emma and she's doing a PhD. But she actually laughs at me because she tried to give me a hug and I just literally froze. And she just started laughing and I like started moving away from her. Like, what? Okay, this is happening then. And I don't know why it is. I don't know if it's because I'm just short or what it is. I tell you, honestly, one of my friends thought they were hilarious. They bought me a social body language book for my birthday and were like, you need to read this. This is how you're supposed to act in social groups. I was like, hey, are you kidding me? So hugs, I think they perhaps serve a purpose in terms of smoothing over social relations. And just to follow up what Claire was saying, I do think it's a particularly gendered thing. You know, a need that women, perhaps, not all women obviously, but some women, you know, this need to want smooth relations and be liked and to make sure there's no bad feeling or anything like that. And I just wonder if it comes back to the burden of emotional labour as well. And having to make sure that everything is proceeding well. And I think there's ramifications for that. So, but as a general rule, please don't hug me.
I'm not going to make you hug me, don't worry. I'm not going to do that. Anyone here naturally a non-hugger? Would you wince if I came to hug you? Yeah, I'm going to lunge back to you. Lunging back. I won't lunge too close.
I don't know, I feel awkward. It's not so much the going to hugging and coming away. It's that bit you described of, right, do I let go now or do I stand here or what do I actually do? I'm fine with my kids, my husband and stuff. But yeah, somebody hugged me the other day at work. I hadn't seen them for ages, know them really well, and hugged me and they were just like, what are you doing? You're just standing there like an idiot. So, no, not for me.
How can I lunge? I'm lunging. I've got to lunge around the other side of the room. This is like the Krypton Factor assault course. Here we go. Yes, yes, Madam Hello.
Yes, definitely non-hugger. Work here in the business school and we're a non-hug environment, which I'm pleased to say. Not that we're unfriendly or anything like that, but I think it's a dangerous position to be in when you're thinking about hugging. Certainly, I came late to academia even later than Michelle, having worked in a very toxic workplace with certain men who liked to hug for other reasons. So I think workplace boundaries, I think you've got to be a bit careful with.
You'd even turn down a hug from Hakim. He's obviously...
I'm sure you're a lovely person, but I'd need to know you a lot better before.
I'm just going to lunge at you. I'm sorry for lunging at you without any notice, but as one of the only a couple of men in the room, do you think it's a gendered thing? Would you hug in a business or a work situation?
I haven't been in the proper work situation yet. Certainly as friends, I find that younger people are generally more...
Because you are young, yes.
More huggy, yeah. And yeah, it's weird because I think there's a certain age group where I think it's not appropriate, but then I'd say older people, it's more appropriate to go for a hug than a handshake. There's almost like a gap at present in my head, at least.
There's the non-hug years, but once you've passed those, you can go to hugging.
Yeah.
We need to get some sort of chart together. I feel we're getting into quite difficult territory. Yes.
So I wanted to raise touching. Because, I would hug, but not sort of every day, you know, hello, good morning, how are you? But if somebody, for example, hadn't seen for a while, I think Claire gave the example, and that would be quite natural. But I'm quite intuitive, and I was sitting the other day actually handling a staff disciplinary matter, and the person was getting very upset. And the next thing I know is I'm actually touching them, and I'm stroking their arm, and I'm thinking, actually, that's really inappropriate. Or is it? Because I was just reacting to the distress, and I wanted to try and just say, look, it's okay, let's calm things down.
It's a maternal nurturing.
Well, yes, and then I just thought to myself, actually, am I going to get into trouble now? Because I've just touched somebody that I'm carrying out a disciplinary process with. But it was just an instinctive reaction. And I think the touching thing's interesting. And the other thing I think is interesting is, as a woman, I find it very uncomfortable knowing, actually offering my hand to shake people. I think... I don't know whether that's a very male thing, shaking hands. If somebody put their hand out to shake, I would shake their hand, but I probably wouldn't think of putting my hand out to shake theirs first.
We definitely need a chart. Can you do some proper research, Claire, and sort this out once and for all? Forget this health informatics stuff. Yes.
I think it's some really important points there drawn by the audience where I feel I need to clarify my quote, women are up for it comment. Because I wouldn't want that to be misconstrued in any way, because there is that, you know, if you are, and I guess is where the author who you mentioned earlier is perhaps alluding to, is the fact that if you're too tactile, when does that cross? And we can all women in the room can probably think of an incident or a few in the kind of Me Too low level blokes going a bit, enjoying their hug a bit too much or whatever. So I think we do need to address that serious element of it. So maybe that's why the gender thing comes into it, that you're more comfortable hugging someone of the same sex as you and so on. But at the same time, you don't want a sort of situation where, for example, teachers in schools, a child's crying or whatever, they're not allowed to do a natural comfort thing. Because of the, and we all know why, but it also kind of takes away that human interaction, that natural interaction that the lady in the audience was just talking about. So we need to get the balance for sure. But you wouldn't want handshakes to be the only way. That's a very formal and it actually restricts us. And also, if we want to return to one of our earlier points, is it another example of where the world is set up for the male handshake and not for the female hug? And what does that underneath, what does that mean, that certain ways of performing and acting are more valued in the workplace than female ones?
I cannot wait for you to give your comments on this. It's been a joyful discussion. Podcast at northernpowerwomen.com is where you can email. At northpowerwomen is where you can tweet. Thank you so much. Wonderful panellists. We've had an absolutely wonderful afternoon. I can't believe how much cake is left. Your restraint has been fantastic. I'm sure it's going to disappear. It'll be like beautiful locusts in just a moment. But a huge round of applause, please, to our panellists. A big thank you to Michelle, to Hakim and to Claire as well. Thank you so much. A tremendous thanks again to our panellists. I'm sending you all a virtual hug right now. And thanks also to the Business School at Newcastle University. Now, if you'd like to host us in the future, we'd love to come and see you. Do get in touch. We can let you know all the details. Just email podcast@northernpowerwomen.com.
Now it's time to learn some more and also hear some great stories from someone who's really made it big in their chosen field. This month, a woman who left the place that she called home and to a degree left her family to pursue her career ambitions. The managing director of Duke's Hotel, Deborah Duggar. I asked Deborah what it was about hotels that just captivated her.
Yeah, I always wanted to work in hotels from being a child. So it was the one thing when we went away as a family. I used to love going into hotels and, you know, playing checking in and checking out when my parents used to take us away. And the one thing I always said is I'd love to work in hotels. So after studying, the one thing I decided to do, much at that time to my father's disagreement, I said I wanted to come and have a career in hotels.
And you started behind reception, is that right? But did you always have ambitions, though, that I'm going to run this show?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a vision and I knew one day I wanted to be a general manager of a hotel. So I started off really as a trainee manager and spent a lot of my time working in front of house. I loved reception. I loved housekeeping. I loved everything that comes with the front of house side of the business. But I did cover all departments.
What's the magic of the hotel for you?
It's hospitality. I love hospitality. It's about people. It's about making memories.
So when you were kind of on the way up, it's sometimes hard, isn't it, when you're very ambitious and you think, I want to be up there, but I'm here right now and I know I've got to put that time in to kind of pay my dues and get my experience. How did you deal with knowing you had to go through that process?
Really, it's about hard work and asking a lot of questions on the way. I was working in a middle management position with a lot of male colleagues. So the female gender was very, very low in middle management and hotels in those days. So I was one of the very few females doing the role I was doing. But I did used to ask questions on the way. I always used to ask my seniors what they were doing, what was their day, what they had planned for the day, what their targets were, what they've achieved. So I was never frightened to ask questions to actually, you know, grow, so my journey would actually grow, my own career would grow. I asked a lot of questions on the way.
As one of the few women around, did you ever feel self-conscious of that fact? Did you have the belief you would be able to rise right to the top?
I've had my challenges. I think any successful female who's in a, you know, a board level position would say the same. But I always believed in what I was doing. I always knew what I was going to be doing. So I think if you've got belief in yourself and you know what you're going to be doing and you believe in actually the task you can achieve, I think that's half the journey.
Who were your role models?
At the time, I had a lot of role models. One of my greatest mentors was Peter Ledra, who used to be chairman of Glen Eagles Hotels. I used to listen a lot to Peter. He really helped me. Yes, no, he wasn't a female. A lot of people said, did you have a female mentor at the time? It was hard to have a female mentor at the time because it was a very, very male-dominated industry. So it was very, very hard to have that. However, I did learn an awful lot from Peter. There was another gentleman called Bernard Aylward, who I learned a lot commercially from. He was a very commercial side of the business rather than actually the operational side of it. So I used to learn a lot from him. I remember a couple of times I asked if I could go and sit in a board meeting with him just to observe and take notes and learn what a board meeting was all about, and he allowed me to do that. So little things like this I don't ever forget because it was part of my journey and it was part of me growing, and I do the same now. So I do the same with my colleagues who work with me, part of our team. I take them to events with me. I encourage them to attend meetings that I'm chairing. It's all part of learning and developing.
Part of learning and developing and growing, I know that you've said in the past, is failing as well. Failing is a really important part of growing. When have you had a moment of failure in your career?
A moment of failure, I need to think about this one. I can't think of one, if I'm being very honest with you. I think I've took my career step by step. So I don't think I've had a failure because I wasn't, as in nowadays, a lot of the younger generation, they want to actually be a manager before they've actually learned how to actually, you know, pour a cup of tea. Manager, the name is absolutely huge. For me, it was about learning the task of the duty. So it wasn't just about actually, you know, the title at the time. It was more about the journey. So I don't think a sort of a step by step side of it, I've had a failure. I would say I took my time in getting where I wanted to be, albeit a little bit slow in the early years, but it was successful.
Was it slow in the early years because you were also a woman and had a family, because you have two children?
In those days, I'm talking about really early years, but I knew what I wanted. When I had my daughter, I came back to work. I was 23 years old, and I came back to work after 6 weeks. Now, in those days, I remember the day I actually gave birth to Lauren, the next day I got a telephone call from my boss at the time, and his question to me was, when are you coming back to work? I'd literally only given birth 12 hours beforehand.
I'm amazed you could remember how to use a phone.
Well, the mobile phones were rather big in those days. You couldn't lose it, put it like that. So yes, I, you know, when I had Lauren, I knew what I wanted, and I knew I wanted to go back to work. Being in hospitality and being in middle management at the time, I was the only female, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to lose my position here. And it was almost, I had a point in my career, oh no, I'm pregnant, I've just got to a middle manager, what's going to happen when I go back to work? I shouldn't have felt like that, but I did feel like that. And it was my decision to actually go back to work. I got childcare for Lauren, and I went straight back to work after 6 weeks. Now, you know, in those days, the actual childcare was costing me more almost than I was making. But the way I looked at it, and the way that I encourage as well, you know, females of today, don't think that the childcare is just coming out of your salary. Look at it as it's coming out of yours and your partner's salary. You know, split that childcare cost. Otherwise, you know, a lot of ladies would never go back to work. And people who I mentor ask me this a lot about, how can you afford childcare? And I said, you know, you have to park the fact that childcare is coming out only of your salary. You have to think of it coming out of a joint salary. So having Lauren was, it was great. I have no regrets, and I loved the fact that I had her at the age that I did have her now. She's my very best friend now. And, you know, that was a challenge on the journey. And once I had Lauren, I made a decision 2 years later, okay, I'm going to have another baby. Let's get my children up. Done exactly the same with Curran, 6 weeks and straight back to work. And I know a lot of mothers will listen to this and they'll think, oh my gosh, how did you do that? But I was staying away, you know, 2 and 3 times a night. I was an area manager. I'd just taken on an area manager's role at the age of 23, you know, just given birth to, you know, a baby girl, and was staying away 2 or 3 days a week. And, you know, but I'd done it. And I think being young and being driven made me do it. I didn't think about it. I just got on and done it. Now, if you want a career and you want to actually, you know, succeed, you've got to be prepared to work hard, work long hours, be organized. And organizational skills are so important. I think if you're organized at home, then you're organized at work. I used to plan for, you know, 2 days ahead of myself all of the time so I could be organized. I don't think there's any industry that would be more challenging as far as hours go, because hotels don't close at 24 hours. And, you know, still to this day, I may be managing director of the group, but I still work anything between 12 and 16 hour days. It's what we do. It's hospitality.
Mm. You work globally. You work all around the world, Deborah, and lots of different cultures as well. Women are often less represented in the business world and some of the other cultures you work in. I'm thinking about Dubai, of course, where Dukes has a hotel. Has this given you any challenges?
I've worked with the Middle East now for 5 years. It hasn't given me any different challenge than anywhere else in the world would. Over in Dubai, all of the top positions over there are actually, you know, headed by a guy. But I would sit in a boardroom, and I'd sit in a boardroom of, you know, 8 or 10, how many ever numbers of guys over there. And I think if you believe in yourself, you know what you're doing, There's no problem. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. I think if you've got, you know, a sort of a question mark about I don't know this or I'm not confident to be able to actually manage this in front of powerful guys, then I think that's an issue. But for myself, I always do my research and almost make sure I'm well prepared no matter what country I'm in, and respect the culture. The big thing for me, I have travelled the world. I still travel the world with work. But the big thing for me is believing in yourself and also respecting culture no matter where you are in the world.
Mm. You've been so driven in your career, so focused. You've always had your eyes on where you want to be. Is there anything you've had to sacrifice?
Of course, I've had to sacrifice my, you know, my personal life. Without a doubt, I've had to live away from home. I'm, you know, managing director at the moment, and I still live away from home 4 days every single week, 4 nights a week. I don't live at home. You know, I've had a great husband who's actually supported me. You know, support is absolutely key. I've sacrificed my family, without a doubt. I sacrificed, you know, my children's school, my children's upbringing. But I have no regrets.
As you said, Deb, you've worked south for so many years now, and yet your family home always remained in the north. Why was that important to you?
The north is so important to me. And if anyone asks where I'm from, I say Northumberland. However, I live there 2 days a week. I'm in Northumberland 48 hours a week. But Northumberland is my home. Northumberland is my postcode. And that's where I live. I love the people of the northeast. I just love, in general, the whole culture of the north. For me, London is exciting. You know, the world's exciting when I travel. I enjoy that side of it as well. But certainly, you know, I think the north has an awful lot of offering. And it's where I started. It's where I actually started my career. And, you know, the north is what got me to senior management.
What's the one thing do you think Deborah could change now to get more women into hospitality at those higher levels?
I think it's about women wanting to do it. I don't think it's always to do with actually the company or the actual industry. I think it's about, you know, females actually believing in themselves and believing that they can get there and they can do it. And actually knock down the barriers. Don't keep the barriers up. You know, it doesn't matter what industry you're in. There's an awful lot of barriers. But I think if you knock your barriers down and then look at how you can overcome those barriers, really the world's the oyster in every industry.
Mm. And finally, for you, how do you prioritise your time? I think I might know the answer to this. How do you prioritise your time so work doesn't always win the battle for your time? Or does it just always win?
It always wins. Yeah, I've got to say, it's, you know, I'm a 24 hours on call and, you know, 7 day a week. For 6 years of my life, it was 6 days a week because Dubai opens on a Sunday and London opens on a Monday. So my only day, which I called my prayer day, was a Saturday. So I used to work, you know, 6 days a week for 6 years. I'm not saying it's right. You know, I don't want anyone listening to this thinking that's right. I'm not saying it's right. I chose to do it because I was driven and I wanted to do it. However, when I've actually got time off or when I've got prime time with my family, that's my family time. So, you know, once a month as a family, you know, we all have a dinner or a lunch together, you know, my two kids with their partners, and we all have a lunch together. So I think prime time is important, but it's about, you know, prioritising. My daughter is a paediatrician. She's actually now a mum herself and is straight back to work. Also, you know, we've put Suki straight into nursery, and she's actually taking, you know, people say to me, how can Lauren do this? What is she doing? And again, I think she's just driven by my success. You know, from what I've done, she's seen what her mother's done and she thought, right, okay, I can achieve it as well. And I think if you've got a mentor as well and someone who you can actually talk to outside of your own, you know, sort of workforce, and really just someone who's there for you to ask these questions, I think that helps also.
And a really big thank you to Deborah, and thank you as well to the beautiful suite that she'd arranged for us to do the interview in. Stay and relax for a while afterwards, she said. I had 15 minutes until my next meeting. It was gutting. If not, I think I would probably actually still be there now. Now, if you'd love to hear someone on this podcast, do let us know. Just email podcast@northernpowerwomen.com. It's time now for Ask the Hive, a place where you can share your job niggles and the awesome Northern Power Women Collective come and lend some advice. This month, Kate does not like getting feedback.
terrible at getting feedback from my managers. I take it really personally and dwell on the negatives. Help!
I would see it as an opportunity to go away and learn and grow personally. Try not to dwell on it too much and get clarification of where you think you might possibly not agree with them, but see it as an opportunity to grow.
I think that the best thing to do is to be honest and open with your line manager that you're struggling to receive the feedback, that you might be taking it too personally. Get their help and support to understand how you can move forward with that feedback in a positive way and allow it to improve your personal development.
I think feedback's a bit of a gift. Smile and say thank you and then reflect on it. People generally have your best interests at heart, so why is that important and how do you want to take it forward? You can ignore it, you can do something differently, or you can ask for more clarification and just keep talking about it. It is difficult to take negative feedback, but it's usually done with your best interests in the centre of it.
I think ultimately it comes down to reflection and also recognising that a lot of issues that happen within the workplace are down to the system as opposed to the individual. So looking to see whether you could have done something better, but equally, if your manager could have done something better to accommodate yourself. So ultimately, it's best to reflect and look at all of the different factors that have led to the negative outcome. And looking at the bits that could be changed by yourself, looking at the bits that were out of your control, and then looking to see whether there was someone else that could have helped with the aspects that were out of your individual control.
My advice would be to accept the feedback, but ask your manager how you could improve on that behaviour or that activity.
A big thank you if you took the time to offer your advice this month. Now it's time to hear from Jude, who's got a problem with her boss taking advantage of her time.
Hi, I've got a question. My boss keeps asking me to do things that aren't my job. I'm not her secretary, and I'm not supposed to run errands for her, but she asked me to fetch her coffee, nip to the shop and collect things that she needs, things that are nothing to do with work. It's not my job, but she's my boss, and I feel in an awkward position, and I don't know how to tell her this isn't acceptable to me, and I don't want to do it without causing trouble at work because she's my boss. Thank you.
So what to do? Have you been in this situation? Can you help? What's your advice, please? Do get in touch. You can either record a voice memo on your phone and email it to podcast@northernpowerwomen.com or just open up WhatsApp on your phone and add the Northern Power Women podcast on 07928 387 712. That's 07928 387 712. All you need to do is hold down the little microphone icon in your message window. Whilst you're holding that icon down, say what you'd like to say, and when you take your thumb off, the message will be sent directly to us. And of course, most importantly, to Jude. So thank you so much. If you need details again of how to get in touch on that, just head to northernpowerwomen.com and click on the podcast page. So there we go for another month of great stories, great advice and brilliant ideas. A full 18 episodes of the Northern Power Women podcast. Huge, huge thanks for listening. Please do tell anyone you know who might be interested. Just pop us in a loved one's stocking for Christmas. We'd really appreciate it. Save the date then. The next episode arrives on Thursday, the 3rd of January, 2019. Good grief. Until then, this is the Northern Power Women podcast. I'm Sam Walker, and this has been a What Goes On media production for Northern Power Women.